Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/plainlabel. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Kindle, Android, or MP3 player. Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Podshots.
You interested in fashions, huh, Monica?
I saw three of these dusters a short time ago. They were waiting for a train. Inside the dusters, there were three men.
So?
Inside the men, there were three bullets.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1968 classic Western, Once Upon a Time in the West. Based on a story by Dario Argento, Bernardo Bertolucci, and Sergio Leone, the film was written by Sergio Leone and Sergio Donati, and directed by Sergio Leone. The film stars Charles Bronson, Henry Fonda, Jason Robards, and Claudia Cardinale. Here to discuss the film with me is my Fumble Rooski podcast co-host, Mr. Travis Seabrass.
I think you pronounced all those Italian names correct.
Can you believe that? One take.
I'm impressed.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. Mr. Seabrass, a little different than our Fumble Rooski Nebraska Cornhusker football talk, it is drink roll call time. What do you have beverage-wise for me?
I'm drinking during Fumble Rooski, too. You just don't ask me.
Yeah, that's true. It's also usually a Sunday morning recording, so that's interesting.
It's noon somewhere.
Right.
Well, I was starting with a Revolution anti-hero, but because you were taking a while to do your business, I've now transitioned to a left-hand milk stout nitro.
Oh, nice. That sounds good.
It's very good.
I have two different beverages that I'm going with as well. The first is was purchased just for this recording. It is from, the Wasatch, maybe? I don't know if that's how you pronounce that, but it is called the Ghost Rider. And it is a white India pale ale, but it is a picture of a dead horse and a dead cowboy on top of him, it looks like.
Nice.
And then, yeah, and then the other one is a beverage that it's like a limited edition from a beer that I believe you introduced to me, but it is the Newcastle Cabby. And it is a limited edition black ale there. So I got the white ale and the black ale. The white hats and the black hats.
I'm relatively sure the only thing I introduced you to was Bush Light.
Yeah, right. I think that I had Newcastle for the first time hanging out with you. But I could be wrong. All right, with that, let's begin our discussion on the 1968 film Once Upon a Time in the West.
A few dollars more, and the good, the bad, and for the Ugly, starring Claudia Cardinale, Henry Fonda, Charles Bronson, and Jason Robards. A Manhunt. A Vendetta. In a new land, in a new kind of Western.
And the IMDb plot synopsis is as follows. This is a story of a young woman, Mrs. McBain, who moves from New Orleans to Frontier, Utah, on the very edge of the American West. She arrives to find her new husband and family slaughtered. But by who? The prime suspect, coffee lover Cheyenne, befriends her and offers to go after the real killer, assassin gang leader Frank, in her honor. He is accompanied by Harmonica on his quest to get even. Get-rich-quick subplots and intricate character histories intertwine with such artistic flair that this could, in fact, be the movie to end all movies. So, you, much like the previous film that you were on this show for, which was Unforgiven last fall, I believe, this was a movie that you came to me with, basically. Like, I knew that you liked Unforgiven, so I think I said that we should do that. But this was your recommendation once upon a time in the West. So what is your what's your history with this?
The first time I saw it actually was when I was living with you.
Weird.
Yeah. My dad happened to be in town, and it was on AMC, I think, back in AMC's infancy. And I just kind of sat down and watched it with him. I was like, holy shit, this Western is unbelievable. You know, and I wasn't a big Western guy back then. I'm still not a huge Western guy. You know, I like good Westerns, but I'm not going to sit down and watch just any Western, you know.
How about High Noon? What do you think about that one?
No.
Yes! I'm not a fan of that either.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some John Wayne Westerns I like, but I thought this movie was just, you know, it's, there's so many things about it that just make it absolutely unbelievable, and it's a Western that defies the genre. You know,
yes.
If you think of Western, you kind of think of cheap violence and things like that. And that's what I think Once Upon a Time in the West and Unforgiven, they really break the mold of that and they go to a higher level.
Yeah.
Film.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. For me, the history of this film is I have no history. This was a first watch. This was, I was a little bit intimidated by it because these films that are classics and especially Western classics, I don't always know how I'm going to feel about them. And so I was a little bit apprehensive going into it, but it took me all of maybe about 30 seconds. And then I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be fine. Like, I'm going to be just fine with this. So getting into the film, then my first note was that I really love the opening, and I guess it carries on throughout the film, but I was really struck at the beginning of the movie at just the general stillness of it all. You know, like there wasn't all this background noise. There wasn't all this, just busyness going on. It was just very still and calm. And even though it was life or death situations, everyone was just sort of, there was no hysteria. You know, there was an everyday situation where, oh yeah, and people are going to get shot and it's fine. And, you know, that it's just the way of the world, and I really kind of liked how they set up the film with that sort of style, I guess.
Yeah, you look in that first scene, that's almost 12 minutes of nothing but silence.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. The ticket agent says a couple words, he gets shoved into, you know, basically a closet,
right,
for lack of a better word, and then you just, all you hear is, you know, the windmill, the sound of the water hitting the guy's hat.
Yep.
And, you know, the guy kind of scooping water out of a trough. And for 12 minutes, that's pretty much all you get until Charles Bronson shows up when the train stops.
Well, there is this, I do want to acknowledge the fly on the guy's face.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Because That's ridiculous. Like, I'm sitting there watching it going, now what exactly is happening? You know, like, how in the world are they doing this? Like, you know, because I figure it's some kind of movie magic. They couldn't just have this fly that just happened to go along with the scene, right?
You don't think they can train a fly like that?
I'm guessing not.
No.
So I was like, well, maybe it's a little, maybe he's got some shit all over him. There's a fly all over. But I just thought that was really kind of remarkable. I was like, wow, look at this fly, like, just hitting all of his cues, like hitting all of his marks.
So that's a Washington of flies.
That's right. And, yeah, so then we do get Charles Bronson, or Harmonica, shows up. And, you know, one of my favorite lines in that opening salvo there is, you know, he says, it looks like you're, or he says they're a shy one horse. And he says, actually, you brought too many, saying that they're only going to need one, you know, when there's three horses, four guys. And he's basically telling them he's going to kill all of them, which I was a little like, cause he knows right away that these are Cheyenne's men and they're just going to kill him. I was a little unclear about that. They're Frank's men at the beginning. Okay. Yes. That's right.
They're dressed as Cheyenne's men.
Right. Okay. That's where my mix up was, I think. But yes. That makes much more sense to me now. So I do like that. And again, with the silence, I really like the sound of the gunfight there at the beginning, to where it's almost like, the last time I really felt this way was when I went to the theater and watched The Departed in the theater, to where the gunshots are so shockingly loud, to where it wasn't just 80s action movie, you know, shoot 'em ups. It was like, it would sort of make you sit upright and like, holy shit. You know, like, this is actually something important. It's not just, they're fighting and they're shooting each other, whatever. And so I thought that, again, was a little bit of sound design that I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's created by the fact that there is almost no sound that first 12 minutes until that.
Sure.
You know, it's all background noise for the most part until you get those first couple shots.
Yeah. And then early on we get the main, you know, plot point where, is it McBain? Yeah, McBain is in the rest of his family is killed. And what I really like about that is I like how right after he's killed and everyone's, you know, dead, they have the point of view from those that are killed and you see these guys and they just have their hats and their dusters. And they sort of are like an angel of death kind of thing that like they're not from the, you know, from the point of view and from the way that like there's the dust over them and you can't really distinguish who they are individually. Like I really found that to be really striking. Like I thought that was particularly well done, you know, especially for, I don't know that I gave this film as much credit going into it because it's a 1968 Western. I was like, oh, it'll just be and look like a traditional Western. Because over at Filmographies, I'm doing Sam Peckinpah films with Cameron. And a lot of those Westerns aren't, you know, I think they're better than your average ones, but they're a lot of very traditional Western. And that's kind of what I thought this was going to be. But I was really struck by the sound and by the different shots that they had in this. And I was really very impressed with this one.
Yeah, you look at that panoramic shot where those guys just materialize out of the brush.
Mm-hmm.
When they're walking up there and all of a sudden you see, okay, there's, you know, you see one, two, three, four, and then the fifth guy comes into, and that's Frank, you know, comes in. And then there's throughout the movie, there's all these tight shots, very focused on people's faces.
Oh, sure.
That, you know, really stands out to me in this film as being something, you know, cinematography wise, this film was shot in such a beautiful way.
Yeah, well, and everyone looks so leathery.
Yes.
Like, I'm like, oh, God, this looks miserable to be in.
And they all do an incredible job with their eyes, because their eyes, in those tight shots, that's what you're immediately drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just the way that those actors just nailed their parts with their eyes.
Oh, absolutely.
I think just really stands out to me in this movie.
Yeah, one of the things that I really found interesting, and it's one of the reasons why I was a little confused about the Cheyenne and Frank thing at the beginning, was I had no like, I didn't read the plot synopsis. I didn't look at anything before starting the film. So I had no idea, like, who was supposed to be the good guy and who was supposed to be bad. Because, you know, I knew Jason Robards from The Ballad of Cable Hogue, that was a Sam Peckinpah film. And here he plays Cheyenne. And there he was kind of like he's the protagonist of the film. But I was kind of, like, I could very much believe that he would be the bad guy. And so I was kind of like, okay, well, I don't know what this guy's up to. You meet Charles Bronson, and he's killing some people at the beginning. And in that bar sequence, he's I think that sequence is amazing, but he is playing a little like a smiling psychopath, is what I wrote him down as, when he's playing that harmonica in that first bar sequence with Cheyenne. And I was really struck by that because he didn't look like rough, gruff, serious Charles Bronson.
Mm-hmm.
He looked a little bit more like unbalanced to me. And so I was like, well, Jesus, I don't know if all three of these guys are bad or if they're good or what the fuck's going on. And then when you finally sort of get to meet Frank a little bit more, you're like, oh, okay, well, this is clearly the bad guy. But yeah, I was really struck by that. And I wrote a couple of times in my notes, I wrote, you know, this sequence is amazing. Favorite scene of the film. Oh, no. And then later it's like, oh, this is my favorite scene in the film. But that opening bar sequence with harmonica, and you get that theme, his theme that he plays, and that is on, in the sound frequently when he's in the scene. You have the beginning of that, and that's something that'll be heard as the film, as this discussion goes out, but it was something that I really, again, liked quite a bit.
Yeah, it's another thing I like about this movie, is that, you know, you don't know who the good guy is and who the bad guy. I mean, you know that Frank, after he shoots, you know, the whole family, is a sociopath, but you don't have a real good feel. I mean, you know Cheyenne is a bad guy, because you don't pin something like that on a good guy and have everybody believe that a good guy did that.
Sure.
And then, you know, Harmonica, you don't really know what his intentions are. You don't have any idea why he wants to find Frank until the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
So there is no real, there's no white hat in this, you know, it's not like a John Wayne movie where, you know, there's a white hat from the beginning and there's a black hat.
Right.
You know, there's a couple gray hats, or I think there's one gray hat and there's two black hats. But, you know, one of those black hats isn't such a bad guy.
Sure. And so, you know, another thing that I kind of came into this expecting, just because it was a Western, was that the female wasn't going to have a particularly large role. Like, she was going to be the damsel in distress, and it was just going to be mostly about, you know, who either gets revenge for her and ends up with her and all that. And I thought that she was particularly good. I think that the scene that I really like with her is when the family is dead and oddly just like splayed out on top of their coffins, which I thought was weird. But
on the tables,
that's right. I liked her expression when she's just walking by them. She doesn't like wail and cry and say a lot of things and have like this big tragic speech. And what I like about it is it's sad, but it's not a tragic thing. Like, it's not a very uncommon thing to where this is in this world, these things are possible and probable. And that's what I kind of liked about it, to where it was just kind of like, well, this sucks for her. But, you know, it's not out of the ordinary kind of.
No. And, you know, that whole scene is just amazing how she, you know, she's supposed to meet her, she's already met her husband in New Orleans and they got married there. But this is supposed to be like a big wedding scene when she arrives on the train. No one's there to pick her up. She eventually gets a ride out there from some crazy old guy.
Right.
And she walks up there and, you know, they're all splayed out on tables. You know, she pauses a moment with the husband, walks by two of the older kids, and then, you know, kind of stops at the younger kid. And that's where they, you know, kind of have a moment there. And then you see the funeral and everybody, you know, once they find a piece of a duster, so they immediately think it's Cheyenne. Everybody just like takes off and she's left all alone out in the middle of nowhere. And that's one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
She's just kind of alone.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that that's really, really good. The only thing that I find a little bit unfortunate about it is, you know, is the dubbing is not super good on her sometimes.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you can tell it's dubbed a little bit and you're like, okay, well, you know, what are you going to do?
She was very much an Italian actor. She never really tried to make it big in America.
Yeah, she's something else.
She's a looker.
She is a looker, especially when she gets into that circumstance with Frank.
Yeah.
You're like, holy shit. Like, what the hell is going on here? That was one of those where it's like, you're watching it and you're like, oh my God. And at the same time, you're like, oh my God. Because it's like a, you better just go ahead and go along with this or else this is trouble for you kind of a situation, you know?
Well, she knew what she was doing.
Absolutely she did. And that's one of the things that, I really liked was that the forced selling of her property, you know, because they set up the fact that, that her husband got a shitload of wood and was going to build the station because the railroad is going to go by there and they were basically going to just make a fortune on this station, this stop along the, what's that?
Sweetwater.
Sweetwater, yeah. And so then, you know, what's Frank's boss's name? I don't even know, or his buddy, the dude that's got the fucking, he's got the crutches.
He's got a lot of things wrong with him.
Yeah, that was one of those where it's like, okay, I didn't need it to be that obvious that he was struggling. Like they could have pulled it back just a touch, but that's all right. That's all right. That's kind of your kooky character.
1880s, you know, they didn't have modern medicine back then.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't have I was waiting for there to be like leeches on him and shit.
Yeah, he's the railroad. I'm sure he has a character name, but he's basically a railroad baron.
Yeah, and so the idea was that you know that guy is wanting her to sell the property, right?
Morton,
okay. He's wanting to get that property basically so he can get all the money that'll eventually come to him. And she has to, you know, she's being forced by Frank to sell. And they go to the auction house and all of Frank's buddies are making sure nobody else buy it and bids on it. And, you know, Harmonica comes in and has this dramatic 5,000 line. And then everyone's all butthurt about that, but I like,
you're missing the point about him, you know, getting the money by basically turning Cheyenne in.
Yeah, that's true. Because yeah, he says 5,000 and then they basically ask for the money and he goes, it's on its way. And then they show them bringing in Cheyenne who's got isn't it a $4,900 reward or is it right at 5,000?
And right around 5,000, yeah.
Yeah. And then the thing I really like was the next scene, which it's actually the second time that Frank and Harmonica have a meeting, but well, it's the third time technically, but it's the second time in the film that we know of at this point is when they try to buy off Harmonica and they give him $5,001. And I thought that was funny and insulting and it's kind of like, well, why would he go along with that? Like, do you think that, I mean, realistically, why, it's not like they were actually going to get him to go along with that. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, from Frank's point of view, Frank's the baddest animal in the jungle.
Sure.
So while Harmonica is probably not scared of him, you know, maybe Frank thinks, okay, I can get him, you know, get him out of here with 5,000 plus one. Plus, you watch him go to the, you know, the door, and he sees all those gunmen lined up out there.
Mm-hmm.
Frank's got a pretty good, you know, in Frank's mind, Harmonica's dead the moment he walks out of that place.
Sure.
He's got all his gunmen lined up out there. So maybe Harmonica sees that and goes, okay, maybe, you know, odds are stacked against me here. I'll take the offer and then, you know, walk out.
Right.
But I think Frank probably, you know, doesn't believe he's going to take that offer either.
But sure, it's just a way to get him there and to get all of his men set up.
Yeah, it's a movie. You know, it's a device in the movie.
Sure. Yeah, so I don't know. I really like that. I think that I really like the sequence when, you know, this is when Cheyenne has been turned in already, and we have, this is a lot of the Harmonica Frank stuff, and they do the Harmonica saving his ass, but sort of not really saving his ass. You know, like it's getting to the point where, you know, he's after Frank. You know, he wants something from Frank because you see this figure who's blurry at the beginning, and he's walking towards the camera, and you don't really know what that's about. And that continues to come back throughout the film. And at this point, you don't really know why he wants him, or, you know, he mentions a few names, and it kind of looks like, you know, maybe his buddy has been killed or something.
They're all dead guys.
Yeah, it's all dead guys. You're not quite sure. And he won't give him his real name, and Harmonica won't. And you know, they have this shootout where Frank's men have been bought out and, you know, are now supposed to kill him. Because Frank's kind of getting too big for the railroad baron's britches, right?
Yes.
Like, he's getting too big. He's, you know, beginning to not just follow orders kind of a thing. And so, you know, Harmonica's helping save the day, kind of. And that's why I'm like, well, what the fuck? Are these guys going to, like, sort of be buddies? Or, you know, what's going on? And even, you know, Mrs. McBade or whatever, McBain. McBain, she says, you know, basically, why did you save him? And he said, well, there's a difference between saving him and not letting him die. And I kind of like that because he didn't, he maybe shot a guy or two, or at least shot at a guy, but he was just kind of giving him clues more than anything else, like with the clock I'm thinking of particularly. And so I kind of like that, to where it's like, it's not good enough for him to be dead. Like, he's got to be the one to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To where traditionally it'd be like, well, as long as he's dead, whatever, I don't give a shit. But it's like, no, that's not good enough for him. It has to be him in particular that does it. So what else do you have going on? I feel like I'm rambling a lot here, Seabrass. What else is it that you like about this?
You're a rambling man.
I was born a rambling man.
One of the things I really love about this movie is that Leon allows scenes to develop.
Oh, sure.
It's not rushed at all. It's like a slow cooker, basically. Nothing's, you know, flashed out in this movie. It's 2 hours and, what, 45 minutes?
Yeah, it's just a little shy of 3 hours.
Yeah, and there's a cut that's supposed to shorten it by 10 or 15 minutes, and I haven't seen it. I've only seen the full length one. And sure. I can't imagine seeing a shorter one, because he allows scenes to develop. You know, the scene in the bar where Cheyenne and Harmonica first meet, that's like a 15-minute scene, you know?
Yeah.
Where not a whole lot happens.
Yeah, it's a lot of...
loud to go.
Yeah, it's a lot of sizing people up.
Yes.
And trying to, you know, it's a lot of showing, not telling.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a lot of, you know, here's these characters, not, well, this guy is this because he says this, and... You know, it's not real dialogue heavy. And I think that, you know, it's almost 3 hours, but it doesn't feel long at all to me.
And the whole movie's not dialogue heavy.
Right.
For the most part, the only guys that really talk a lot while they're on screen are Morton and Mrs. McBain.
Sure.
Cheyenne, Frank, and Harmonica, they don't talk a whole lot. They're much more old school. And that's one of the things that really stands out to me in this movie, is you have kind of the old West meeting the new West.
Mm.
And you see that played out through the characters.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Mrs. McBain or Mrs. McBain and, Morton, they're new school. They're all about, you know, they represent modernization. Whereas Harmonica, Frank, and Cheyenne are all the old gunfighters. And
right.
You know, their way is getting phased out. And that kind of plays out at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. That's a little bit of what we discussed in Unforgiven, that you liked that, how it does that in that film as well.
Yeah, and that another one of my favorite Westerns is The Shootist. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen that one.
But that also meets that old world gunman, who, in this case John Wayne, who is, you know, running up against modernization. So that might be something that I really stands out to me in Westerns, I guess.
Yeah, it's a theme that you enjoy, apparently. So one of the other sequences that I really enjoyed is when, you know, I think Jason Robards is so good as Cheyenne. Like, for me, I think all of the four leads are good, but Jason Robards is actually of these, I think, the guy I'm most familiar with.
Really?
Yeah.
Not as familiar with Henry Fonda?
No, I'm really not. I'm not very versed in him.
He's totally playing against character.
Sure. I mean, I know his name, but I thought it was strange that he was playing the bad guy, but.
Yeah. And that's one thing I really like in this movie is that Leone casts characters against type.
Sure.
Although Charles Bronson always kind of played the same type of guy where he was always, you know, not really a good guy, not really a bad guy. Just kind of a badass.
Yeah. What's interesting about him is he feels so slight to me. Like, he's a little fella, I feel like.
Yeah, and this is definitely early in his career.
Yeah.
He put on a little more weight as he got older and filled out. But he's definitely, you know, as young as you'll see Charles Bronson in the movie.
Yeah, he's youngish, and he feels so slight, so when he's... You know, when he's trying to get information and figure out where Frank is, and he's got the guy on the clothes wringer, and he's got his tie in there and shit, and he's like shoving that dude around, and I'm like, geez, he's a little fella. Like, he's kind of that little, like the little man syndrome type of guy.
Napoleon?
Well, yeah. I was thinking more like Jesse, but yes. So I think that that's good. But yeah, so Jason Robards, the thing that I was going to mention was I really like the first coffee sequence with Cheyenne and Mrs. McBain.
Yes.
And I think that that's so good because that feels like it could be a little dangerous.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm kind of like, ooh, don't do that, please. Like, don't step over that line. You know, I like how it goes right up to the line of, yeah, he could just kind of have his way with her if he feels like it. And then, you know, you have the same thing with Charles Bronson's character.
Yes.
To where
he goes a little farther.
Yeah, because he's got her and he like kind of shoves her up against like a stack of wood or something.
He tears off like the sleeves of her shirt.
Yeah. And then later he's got her where she's in the bath and he's helping out Frank.
Mm-hmm.
When he's helping him escape. So, you know, all of these guys are like, they're playing at this, oh, hey, I hope you don't get raped by us, you know, kind of a thing. And I'm like, God damn, this poor woman, you know. And then finally it's Frank, you know, that kind of has his way with her. And she's, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, she knows what she's doing. She's staying alive. What did you think of the fact that she was a former madam or a former, I guess not a madam, but she was a prostitute.
She was a pro?
Yeah, she was a pro.
Well, I think if you see Mr. McBain, you'll realize that he probably wasn't gonna, you know, gonna score well.
Yeah, I was struck by that then. I was like, wow, he's got the cash, I guess.
Well, he's poor when he, you know, because he mentions to his daughter, you know, someday you won't have to cook, and it's a pretty meager spread, you know. She talks about, you know, slicing the bread really thin. I mean, they're not living high off the hog where they're at.
Right. Do you think that Mrs. McBain decided to marry him because she was swept up in the promises he made or alleged, you know, would have made? Or do you, like, what do you think she went for him for?
I think she was swept up in the promises.
Yeah, I would think.
I don't think there's any way that, you know, she's going to leave her life there to go hook up with that guy in the middle of Arizona, you know.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. And so what I really liked was, at first I was kind of like, oh, man, like that's, you know, that she can't just be like a good person, like a morally good person, in quotes, you know, to where she had to have been a pro. But the more I think about it, the more I'm like, well, all of these guys are all gray hats. Like, it makes sense for her to be one as well.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, that's one thing another thing I like about this movie is there's no real, there are no saints in this movie, you know.
Sure.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah,
maybe McBain, but that's about it. And he dies, you know, 20 minutes into it.
Sure, so it could be a commentary of, you know, that's bullshit, or this is how people really are.
And you have no feel for him. I mean, the only time you see him is when he's out there with his kid, you know, hunting.
Right, sure.
And that's it, and then he's dead.
Yeah. But so, yeah, I really enjoyed that coffee sequence, you know, and then they have a nice little callback at the very end of the film with that. One of the other things that I wanted to mention is I thought that, you know, I wasn't checking the time. So every time that a big sequence would come up, I was like, oh, shit, are we at the end? Like, is this the end? And as soon as we have the big duel, you know, the harmonica versus Frank, and they're doing it's like the old school, like traditional, all right, mano y mano, let's circle around and let's, you know, draw it out a little bit and we'll focus on the eyes and we'll get the tension real high.
A little, it's like a 15-minute scene. I mean, that's another thing that, you know, when I talk about this being a slow cooker movie, that last scene, it lasts a while.
Yeah, well, and what's nice about it is I love how they're, you know, the 20 paces away or what have you. And then Harmonica, like, steps to where they're about 4 feet away. You know, and they're pretty fucking close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have this duel from short range. And I was like, dang. I was like, that's some balls. Then it's not like, you know, they're not going to miss from there. You know, it's a who's actually fastest kind of a thing. And I was like, that really shows some stones to do that. But, you know, I think that, again, I had already mentioned the music, but the music before that duel and like leading up to it was just amazing. I'm sitting there watching it going, holy shit, you know, just ready for Frank to get his kind of a thing. But yeah, so I really enjoyed that. And okay, now here's one of the things I didn't get. So Harmonica's, Mexican?
Yeah, I think they leave it kind of open, but yeah, he appears to be Mexican.
Okay. I didn't get that. I was like, wait a minute, that's Charles Bronson. Who's this Mexican dude? And I was like, oh, that's supposed to be him?
What's our dad? All right.
Like, what's that?
What's our dad?
Yeah, what's our dad? Oh, that's way inside baseball. because I saw that and I was like, well, who's this little kid? What the fuck? Like, what do we give a shit about this? You know, thinking that, I don't know what I was thinking, but I see this little kid. And then once the harmonica goes into his mouth, I was like, oh, fuck, that's supposed to be him? All right. Because he looks like the least Hispanic guy I think I've ever seen. Like, I think you look more Hispanic than him.
Wow.
But anyway, that was something that, you know, it took me out just for a minute, but it's not like I was like, oh, god damn it. Why couldn't they got a Hispanic actor to do this or something?
Yeah, that reveal is pretty – it's all leading up to that, and to reveal it in the last, you know, 20 minutes of the movie, that took a ton of patience.
Well, absolutely. And what I had mentioned earlier was, you know, we have this figure that keeps walking towards the camera, and I'm expecting it to be the person that was killed by Frank. You know, I think that in traditional Hollywood, that's who it would be, right?
Yeah.
And they'd have some sequence where it'd be like, oh, you're my best pal, and then he gets killed by Frank or something, you know? And here I like that it's Frank, and I'm like, whoa, like what the fuck is this? And you know, it shows Harmonica with, it's his brother, right?
Yes.
It's his brother who is standing on top of Harmonica's shoulders. And if Harmonica moves, then his brother will be hanged to death. And Frank's there just, you know, yucking it up. And you know, he basically either Harmonica just kind of falls over because he's tired, right? It's not like Frank pushes him out of the way or anything, I don't think.
No, he just falls over.
Yeah, he just falls over. But
he's a kid.
Sure. And so, you know, I just like, you get all of that, and you know, I put, what a fucking awesome ending, right? Because I just was so caught up in that moment of finding out why he's after Frank, of having the final duel, and spoilers, you know, Frank doesn't survive. And, you know, I was so caught up in that, that I just figured that was the end. Like that was going to be the end scene. And I had, you know, forgot about what Cheyenne was going to do and what, Mrs. McBain was going to do, and then to have that little callback of the coffee sequence and, you know, kind of cut in that duel. And then you get Cheyenne's death sequence. And that was something, did I miss that, or is that something that we didn't see?
We didn't see it. It happened off camera. Okay. When you see Morton die,
right,
or dying next to his pool, puddle of water, which is symbolic because he was trying to drive to the Pacific.
Sure.
And that was all he wanted to see was the Pacific. Well, the last thing he saw was a small puddle of water.
Muddy water.
He got shot. Yeah, muddy water. He got shot, or Cheyenne got shot by Morton.
Okay. That was one of those things where I was like, I'm watching, how did I miss that? Like, what the fuck?
And he kind of hints at it. He's like, if you're going to get shot, if you're going to get shot by somebody, make sure they know what they're doing. Cause, he's gut shot.
Right.
Cause you don't know he's gut shot. Cause, right. he's in the house with Mrs. McBain, and they're having the coffee, and he wants to shave, and he doesn't let on that he's shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even watch the gun fight.
Yeah, which I thought was so odd because, Harmonica comes in and Cheyenne's ready just to shoot him because he doesn't know which one it is.
Yeah,
I think that was really interesting because it's like the film is at one point telling you that this is such a dramatic thing in Harmonica's life, but in the overall scheme of things, it's not a vastly dramatic moment. Because it's not like there's this audience and there's all these people watching and the two other main players aren't even paying any attention.
Which I think also lends itself to the new world's coming.
Sure.
These two old world guys circling off. You know what? The new world's rushing right past them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also see that when Frank, when he rides up to that gunfight, rides past all the railroad stuff.
Sure.
Just goes right past it. And, he has that little moment with Charles Bronson or Harmonica where he's like, you know what? I couldn't live knowing you're still out there.
Right. Yes.
I can't be the businessman because I know you're still out there.
Mm.
Which I thought was just a very powerful line of dialogue between those two guys in a movie where there's not a ton of dialogue.
Yeah. That's kind of what, there's a lot of pressure on the dialogue, I think, because it's so sparse to where it in order to be effective, it better be good.
Are you trying to say George Lucas, would have to struggle with this movie?
George Lucas. I love that that's like the whipping boy, like he's the only poor screenwriter ever.
He's not a poor screenwriter, just
his dialogue sucks. His dialogue's awful.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get Dan Brown in there, he's also shit. So,
yeah.
Dan Brown has some good plots, but his actual writing is dog shit.
He's the go-to guy.
Sure, George and his neck.
Yes, but, one thing we haven't talked about at all, and I don't mean to divert it.
No, go ahead.
Music in this movie.
Music?
Yes.
Yes. No, I've mentioned the music.
Well, a couple times. We haven't really went in depth on it.
Okay. What would you like to say about it?
Well, I'm going to ask you.
Sure.
What did you think about each character having their own kind of little theme?
Yeah.
Theme song. And every time they came on screen, you kind of knew who it was. I mean, you already knew who it was, but they all had their own music. And sometimes it kind of blended together.
Yes. Well, I liked that a lot. And I liked that you mentioned that it blended them together because it really, it was just like, I don't know. It felt like a play almost to me. Like it felt like, since they were using the themes and the songs as dialogue, I felt like.
Yes.
To where whoever the dominant person in that scene was, it was their song. And then when it would be both of them and they would both be introduced, it would kind of sometimes mesh together or be like on more on one character than the other. And I just thought it was, that was the thing outside of the visuals with it being, that kind of, Clint Eastwood-esque focus on the eyes kind of thing that's what I generally think of with the gunfights. But I think that is very striking. But I think the music was the thing that really sold me outside of the kind of stillness of the film. The music is definitely very, very important. And I think that you know, if that's not done well, then I think the film is still good, but I don't think it reaches the classic status that it is.
I agree.
Yeah, I really liked it quite a bit. Like I think that the harmonica one is the most recognizable just because it has the dominant harmonica playing in it. But I thought that they all had a really nice piece of music. And, you know, it's interesting because this episode is on the heels of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and then the two Hobbit films that have been released. And those are, you know, very heavy into Howard Shore's score, and they all have themes for their people and, you know, with like the Falcons have their own theme and the Riders of Rohan and all this stuff have their own theme. Everyone has their theme. And then, the episode before this one, which was Moon, which was, by Clint Mansell, who did the score there. Like, that's another one that is very heavy and very important into, setting the tone and of the film. And I think that the score is brilliant in that. So inadvertently, we're kind of on quite a streak of scores and songs that are just really, really important to the movies. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. I think movie music is the new class. Is our way to digest classical music now?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think that that's really smart because, you know, you say classical music and I think that like 80 to 90% of the audience would like roll their eyes and go, oh fuck, okay, pianos and strings, all right, whatever. But you play them bits from, you know, this or. You know, our buddy Sean, if you play bits from The Fountain or, you know, some of the other shows that him and I have talked about, to where score is always very important in the films that we decide to discuss. And I think that it is, you know, it is modern day classical music. And I like that a lot. Maybe not so much in the Star Trek films. Because I remember purchasing soundtracks to those. And going, dang, this is cool. And then I watch it, I listen to it now, and I'm like, oh boy, that's like four notes just played over and over.
Why am I not shocked?
Hello, I like my Star Trek. What can I say? I'm multifaceted. I'm watching this Western film. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's true.
So what can you say? I'm all grown up.
You're a big boy now.
That's right. So what do you think? Are you glad that at least we had one survivor of the film? Or were you surprised at Cheyenne's death?
You know, I was, because he didn't act like he was shot up until you see him fall and you're like, what the hell, you know?
Well, he certainly wasn't bleeding a lot or else she would have noticed.
Yeah, he was gut shot. I mean, being a hunter.
Yeah, I was going to say, explain the difference to me there, big hunter.
Gut shots don't bleed a lot, and that's part of the problem. You know, to kill an animal, you either want to take a vital organ or you want to hit an artery and make it bleed to death. Mm-hmm. And you get shot in the gut. That, you know, if I'm going to get shot, I don't want to get shot in the gut.
Just for anyone out there wanting to maybe shoot seabrass.
Yeah. If you're going to shoot me, do it correctly. Do it quick. That's the same theory I live by when I hunt. I want to kill it quick and get it over with. I don't want it to suffer. And I'm the same way. Yeah.
That's the same method you live by in a lot of things. Just get it over with. Do it quick.
Yeah. Gut shots are bad. You suffer when you get shot in the gut.
Sure.
So he suffered.
Right. Yeah. And I like the fact that he didn't want Harmonica to watch him.
No.
You know, he wanted to kind of keep his dignity as much as he could.
And he didn't want Mrs. McBain to watch him either, because I think he had a pretty soft spot for her. And he's to go too.
Yeah, because he, you know, he had said that he had kind of implied that, you know, he could sort of force them together, or, you know, he could see why she would maybe want to stay with him or with Harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's like, you know, basically he was saying, too bad I'm not the right one for you, and he isn't either.
No, like, and when he like says
find
that,
your own person, yeah.
He's already shot.
So. Sure, yeah. So yeah, maybe he just kind of came upon that after the fact, and before he was shot, maybe he would have tried to, you know, go for a spin, so to say. But after he was shot, he's like, oh, you know, maybe you should actually find somebody that's right for you. So I like that, and I like the thing with the, you know, if they grab your ass, just kind of act like it didn't happen, and I'm like, oh, this is okay. I don't know if that would really play.
If only that existed in your college days.
I guess just be like, shh, no, just it's fine. Just pretend like that didn't happen. Yeah, I'm sure that would have played real well. I didn't give it a shot, and maybe it would have. Who knows? Who knows? My college days were not very interesting, sadly.
You know? Trumpet music.
Yeah, sad trombone right there. Insert sad trombone there. So I really like that bit, and I like that, you know, Harmonica doesn't kind of come after her after he's killed Frank and after he's said his goodbye to Cheyenne. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's not like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to be here now and just shack up with her. You know, I kind of like that she is sort of like a, not necessarily like a leader of the town, but she sort of acts like she's a little bit in charge of the town.
Well, she is in charge of the town because she's the only person, the only resident, basically.
Well, yeah, she is. She walks out
there and gives water to all the workers.
Yeah, you know what I think I like about that so much, though, is not that she just gives the water, but she is also, like, talking immediately to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what she says, but it's like she doesn't go out there and is just this meek little scared woman.
No, she walks out there as in charge.
Yeah, she goes out, she's like, here's your water. Oh, you'll want to do this over here or that over there or whatever it is that she's actually saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, you know, I'm the boss kind of a thing. Like, don't fuck around here, boys. Kind of a situation. And I like that. And I think that makes sense with her, you know, being a businesswoman of sorts before. You know, it makes sense that she would be able to put her foot down and be in charge and be kind of a boss, you know?
Yes.
So, I think I like that.
That's the other thing about, you know, Harmonica riding away from that scene is he's going out to where, you know, civilization has reached that spot. But the, you know, yes, the train comes in, civilization's there. He's got to go farther away from it to still exist in his own world.
Yeah.
His like, world is dead there.
Yeah.
He's got to go somewhere to find what his world is.
He's just got to keep going to the coast or, you know, until he runs out of room.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't, you know, it's one of those where he's not adaptable. He doesn't know how to be anything other than what he is. And that's always interesting, you know, when you have, you know, when you have, that'll have to be like the general theme. You know, I was thinking about this the other day to where it seems like all of the people that I have on, we end up having the same sort of themes. And yours, like we've mentioned earlier, is this new world versus old world kind of a thing. But I think it is always interesting when you have a character that is so set in one way and then the complete opposite or something completely different comes and meets him. Like, what does that character do?
Yeah.
And that's always something that I think is worth discussing. You know, it's a much easier topic to discuss than the aforementioned Mr. Stanglin, where it's, you know, who are we? Is there God? Like, that's the sort of movies we do. And I'm like, oh, fuck, these are really heavy. You can't do those very often, because it gets a little too much. But yeah, so, I mean, that's the extent of my notes. Is there anything that you wanted to mention that we had skipped over or anything like that?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything I wanted to say. You know, I think this movie, it stands out for the way it's shot. You know, it's a very slow movie. It's not fast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're into fast movies, you're going to be bored with this one.
Yeah, if you're a Michael Bay fan, you probably wouldn't enjoy it.
The music, I think, pushes this movie to a whole another level.
Sure.
And I think, you know, it's one of the best movies I've ever seen. And I've, you know, I look at that AFI 100 list. I've seen a lot of them on it. It's definitely up towards the top.
Well, sure. And, you know, we poke fun at this list quite often. But, you know, over at IMDb, it is number 24 all time over there. So they're not complete fools. Like, they do get some of the films right that are in their top 250. But yeah, I would say that, you know, if it's not my favorite Western, it's definitely in the top two or three. Because I think that it's not like, You know, I think this is very much a Western period. Like, it's not a Unforgiven to where it's kind of like a New Age Western.
Yeah.
You know, to where this is just comfortably a in the middle of being a Western sort of thing. And I like that, and I think that it's an example of sort of what could be done other than the sort of spaghetti stereotypical sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know? I think Leone's Man with No Name trilogy is really good. I think this movie takes it to another level.
What do you think about the title?
Once Upon a Time in the West? It's,
yeah.
It was actually based on Once Upon a Time in America, which I think he eventually did shoot.
Yeah, I know there's been a bunch of Once Upon a Time in movies.
Yeah.
You know.
And I, you know, one thing I learned while I was researching for this is that Clint turned down the Charles Bronson role.
Eastwood did?
Yeah.
Huh.
Which, I don't know if that really, you know, I think Eastwood's a better actor.
Sure.
Maybe, but I don't know that there was that much to do with that character, that character that Eastwood could have really enhanced it all that much.
Yeah, I think that Bronson's good for it because I like that he is a little more slight. Like I was saying, like Clint Eastwood is so tall and gangly.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a little bit more physically imposing to where I always, you know, even though he wasn't like dramatically much shorter than the other people on screen, I still felt like he was slight. And just, you know, a little fella that was, you know, a tough guy, but he was just little still.
And they kind of shot him in ways to, I don't know, maybe accentuate that.
Yeah, I think so.
They shot him where he was like kind of sitting on stuff a lot. Like he was sitting on counters and things like that. He was never face to face with somebody.
Yeah, except for the duel.
Yeah.
That's about it. And so I like that, like, because it's kind of like, you know, he's a little bit of the underdog all the time, and I just kind of like that that character trait of it, I guess. If you had Eastwood in there, though, like, first of all, you still have the Mexican problem, right? Which I'm just never letting go.
Well, maybe you cast a white guy to be the one that hangs. That's not that hard.
I don't get why they didn't do that to begin with, but anyways, see.
Bronson was kind of tan, you know?
Well, he's very leathery, but I just thought he was leathery just the same as the other guys.
Well, I mean, Jason Robards had the whole beard thing going.
Man, he's got a crazy beard, too.
Yeah.
Like it sticks out in spots. Like, he needs to get that shit groomed up.
Well, I don't think there's quite the barber service in the 1980s as there are now, you know?
Homie couldn't find an outlet to hook up his little barber tech thing.
Says the guy who can't grow a beard.
Oh, please. You wish, son. So, anyway, well, I'm glad that it wasn't Clint Eastwood is what I'm getting around to. Like, I don't think that there's a lot that was, like, I think Harmonica's a really good character. I think that Bronson was perfect for it. Like, I think if it was an actor that maybe had a little bit more range, that they might try to use that range. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad that he's a little bit more limited in his sort of traits and personality. Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of like, look, I know what I'm good at. I'm not trying to do anything other than that. So, I kind of like that. All right, well, do you have anything else, C-Brass? Are you ready to wrap this bitch up or what?
Let's wrap it up.
Okay, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for this show, for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. Just like our regular show, we're going to have an Amazon link on our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. If you click on that link and buy Once Upon a Time in the West, which we obviously would recommend, we do get some of that money and it doesn't cost you anything extra. And since you're already over on our site, we do have a little Amazon box over on the right-hand side just below the movie links. If you click on that Amazon box, it takes you to Amazon's homepage. And so what I want you to do is I want you to bookmark that homepage and then use that link whenever you buy anything from Amazon. And what it does is it doesn't change anything for you. It just gives us a little percentage. It helps us, you know, pay for our Netflix, pay for our movie tickets, you know, pay for all that, the kind of bills kind of a thing that comes along with the show.
Or beer.
Or beer, that's also really good. So, you know, we can't quite get a beer company to sponsor us, so, you know, give us a little cash and then we'll go and buy whatever, maybe whatever beer you want us to. So, I would like to thank Mr. Seabrass for coming on and discussing Once Upon a Time in the West with me. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they do so?
Why do you want to do that?
I don't know. Maybe they want to know about you, Mr. Seabrass.
Seabass18 at twitter.com.
That's right. And you can also find Mr. Seabrass on our season-long podcast, Fumbleroski, which is, you know, the Nebraska Cornhusker football podcast. So you can find that during the season. Like, we're going to do a spring game show, right?
And probably recruiting. I mean,
yeah, probably recruiting. If there's some big news, you know, we'll discuss that. Or, you know, they did have a new coach that was just hired, but and that sort of thing. So that's kind of interesting. But so that's another way that you could find more of Mr. Seabrass over at Fumbleroski. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.